lamp, a bedstead. But they had a grandness. They felt properly proportioned. There was something about the halls, too, about the flow of one room to another. Gwen could intuit, as children can, the correctness in its design. The Lies was the only nice house she ever visited. When she went home, her own 1970s cape felt small and cheaply made, the wall-to-wall carpeting the most modest of comforts compared to those echoing wood floors and fraying rugs and hallways. She couldn't picture playing dress-up at her house, even if they had had a costume box. "Remind me, how did you know each other?" Philippa said curiously. "From tennis?" No, brownies. Girl Scouts." "Girl Scouts. Oh, my word. I'd forgotten Rose did all that. Poor thing. She tried so hard to be normal." She looked hard at Gwen, interest and approval mingling in her expression. "And where in Dunning did you live?"
"Natauqua," Gwen corrected her.
"I'm from Natauqua," she said hurriedly. She wanted no mistake of what she claimed. Dunning had the boarding school and the two white steeple churches on Main. Natauqua was the next town over, with a commuter rail station and a sports bar next to it, a traffic circle with a McDonald's and a Burger King, and, off one of its tentacles, an army base that was slowly being decommissioned. The two towns combined for high school and a few other things. Girl Scouts, a 10K race Thanksgiving weekend at which Gwen's dad, Robert, had officiated before he had the stroke. Not that Philippa or Rosemary Lye had attended the public high school. There was a world of difference in having been a day student at Dunning, as the Lyes had been, and having gone to Dunnott, as the kids called it, Dunning-Natauqua Regional Secondary School, whence Gwen Babineau had been among the few students her year to matriculate to a four-year college. The Ivy League gloss beside the point, gilding the lily. Philippa came around the island to the stools. "Are your parents still there?" She climbed up on the one right beside Gwen, her wine sloshing out on the counter as she did. "Yep." With pride, Gwen added, "Same house." There was something foolish about the two of them. Two grown women, sitting so close together. Gwen would have made a distancing remark. "This is cozy, isn't it?" But Philippa's presence seemed to shame her away from that sort of conventional thinking. After a moment, she volunteered, "My brother tried to get them to move to Florida because the winters are so tough. But my mother won't leave Natauqua. She'll be there till the day she dies," Gwen predicted. "Oh, that's funny," Philippa nodded appreciatively. "Because my father wouldn't leave Dunning all his life. He was born and died in the same house." "Oh, well, the Lye house," Gwen said. "I get that, the best house in the whole town." As soon as she said it, she was mortified at having sounded this sycophantic note. Philippa eyed Gwen and seemed to go on carefully. "It's been raised now. My mother sold it when my father died. They put in condominiums." "What?" Gwen gaped at her. "You are kidding me." She forgot herself entirely. "The big Lye house is gone? Since when?" "That can't be. It was there forever. It was like the anchor of that part of town, the green and everything." She stopped abruptly, realizing how rude she was being. "Yeah, it was there a while, my father's family, or at least," Philippa said lightly, holding up her wine glass and scrutinizing it, "the man I believed was my father for 20 years. Gwen's expression went dunce-like. The outlines of the story were known to her as they were to everyone local. The Lyes were the one name in Dunning. There was Lye Hill, which accounted for half the open acreage of the town. The Lye Bird Sanctuary, Lye Cottage, where the Natauqua Valley Hunt used to stop to refuel. Lye Hall at the Dunning School. And in contrast to those bucolic touchstones, Lye was the name on the textile mill upriver in Natauqua. There had been a scandal when Philip Lye remarried a few weeks after his first wife died. Their cleaning woman, whom the couple had come to depend on more and more as Nessie Lye's cancer advanced. And then in 7 or 8 months, the child, Philippa. It was the kind of story about which Camilla Babineau would say, no doubt had said, "What goes around comes around," enjoying the sentiment, taking pleasure in the fact that you couldn't get away with things. The truth would get you in the end. Sheila.
With an odd, emotionally incorrect satisfaction, Gwen recalled the woman's name. Besides the cleaning jobs, she'd worked nights as a cocktail waitress at Kelly's, the bar on Route 27, just over the Natakwa line. What might Camilla have said exactly? How would she have phrased it? The older girl, you know. Or people say. Her lips tight, like a ventriloquist's. Course the younger girl looks just like her father. No proof needed there. What comes around goes around. He was Rose's father, Philippa assured Gwen. She slipped down off the stool, still clutching her wine glass, and went to the sink, where she peered intently out the small window again. The day, already an oddball, took on a surreal quality. Yet instead of Philippa's private tragedy ushering in some excruciatingly awkward state, Gwen had the strangest feeling. A feeling she hardly ever had in New York. Of an ethereal calm. Philippa was from Dunning, the next town over. Rose Lye's older sister. People, many, might have turned this into, we grew up together. But it was nothing so proprietary as that she would have claimed. It was the most basic of connections they had, that was all. Coming from the same place, ending up here. It was simply that she recognized Philippa. She had known her forever. Knew that there were certain knolls, certain elms, and certain oaks along certain roads. Certain bends in those roads. Certain graveyards and plays of light Philippa had known as well. That's all she would have claimed. If anyone had asked her what growing up there was like in the 70s and 80s, she would have said that the overarching principle, which she had been able to see only lately in reflection, was a randomness. A randomness that had vanished, that this town with its strivey parents, slotting in the schools and the lessons and the vacations and the camps, this kitchen, gut jobs, chain stores, the internet, seemed determined to eliminate. Not to root out, that was impossible, but to pave over and over until you could only regain it now by trying to insert it artificially into one's own child's life. Then there had been a randomness to how things turned out. You might become a model. You might never leave. Our father was Rosemary's father, Phil repeated. I didn't mean to imply. Oh, no, I know. Gwen cut her off awkwardly. Where is Rose these days? I've been meaning to ask. Rosemary? Philippa looked surprised. Oh, she's still in Dunning. In one of the condos they built on our land, actually. They're the only affordable housing in Dunning. She said, why cut off my nose to spite my face? In the quotation, Gwen had a fleeting but vivid flash of Rosemary Lye, who even as a girl had been bent on making pain kneel to practicality. Gwen could remember Rose's saying, over some disappointment visited on the Dunning Natakwa Girl Scouts, it wouldn't have mattered anyway. We wouldn't have been able to stay for long. And then giving some hard-working reason for why the treat could never have been enjoyed. Camilla-like in her will to resignation. Gwen nodded. I could see her doing that. She's enormous, Philippa said, with no modulation in her voice Gwen could discern. Morbidly obese. She walked to the kitchen doorway and glanced down the hall. She chose it, almost. She turned back into the kitchen, her watchful eyes on Gwen. She didn't want my vice, you know. She held up the empty wine glass and shook it. Anything but me. Then, in a hushed tone, she said, get me one more, will you, Gwen? And placed her glass on the island in front of Gwen. I'll keep watch. Sure. Gwen felt stiff getting down and taking the wine out. She filled the glass way up to the top and carried it carefully to Philippa. She was fumbling to put the cork back in the bottle when Philippa stopped her. Just leave it. And when Gwen hesitated, leave it, she ordered. I don't know why I bother. My brother's still there, Gwen said, in Natakwa. She went on with her awkward segue. He's a cop in Dunning, as a matter of fact. Is he? Philippa said absently. But Gwen could tell the connection no longer interested her. Not really. Philippa leaned against the breakfast counter. I always thought I'd move back to Dunning, take up the Lye homestead. I always suspected that leaving was just an interim state. a purgatory I was being forced to endure before I could go home. I mean, really, New York City, Tokyo, can you imagine? Please, none of that had anything to do with me. She gave an exaggerated, comic shudder. I think knowing I was always planning to go home, that there was nowhere nicer than my own home, made me reckless. The security, ironically. If I hadn't had that to rely on, I'd have had to have been a hell of a lot more careful. Yes, you would have, Gwen said. But as I say, Sheila sold it. All at once, Philippa sounded drunk. They raised it that week. She'd let it fall into disrepair, and nobody wanted to restore it. It wasn't quite the right moment, a little early for that. Nowadays, I was in Tokyo. I got fired from a job, and my agent dumped me, and I called home to tell her, and she said, "Well, don't think of coming home, because home's gone." "I'm sorry," Gwen said automatically. "Don't be," countered Philippa. "After all, I'm not a lie, not really. It was a bit of a shock, that's all I'm saying, because I always felt it was the one authentic thing about me, my lineage. Let's say I enjoyed it, even though nobody's ever heard of lies in New York. Isn't that silly? How pathetic, to cling to a name in this day and age." Standing with her back to the sink, Gwen felt weary suddenly, tired to her bones. Minnie's vast kitchen, with its glaring appliances, its sterile surfaces, its imported marble and aggressive obstructionist island, seemed to have itself raised Philippa's childhood house, put up the condos that took its place. There was a silence in which Philippa again examined her glass, tilting the little wine that was left in it back and forth. Gwen turned and busied herself getting a glass of water, remaining at the sink and primly drinking it in gulps, refilling it, wiping with her sleeve at a single drop that fell on the counter. Philippa came over and stood beside her. She set down her wine glass in the sink, and they both looked momentarily out the small window. "Apparently my real father was a truck driver. You know, passing through." Gwen nodded. "There's that Boston to New Hampshire route. It goes through Dunning." Gwen gave another stiff nod. "Makes sense." At the same time, they both heard the clicking of Minnie's shoes across the marble in the foyer. "And your mother?" Gwen asked. "Oh, she's dead," Philippa said. "She didn't get to enjoy the windfall, after all." "I am so sorry," called their hostess before appearing in the doorway. "Lupe is completely useless when it comes to anything technological." Chapter 10. When Dan Hogan was growing up, his father had planned many vacations. On his small-town lawyer salary, Perry Hogan wanted to take his wife and five sons to Disney World. "We've got to do it while they're still young enough to believe," he said. That trip didn't happen, but a few years later, Perry felt their taste as a family, with the boys now between 5 and 12, had grown more sophisticated, and he set his sights on the Caribbean. "It won't be fancy," he admitted freely, but there was an inn on a beach he had read about in a travel magazine he'd been thumbing through in the dentist's office. An inn on one of the less popular islands, apparently. Dan remembered looking up the funny name in the family atlas, Jost Van Dyke. Dan and his brother Tim, the older by 13 months, would lie awake at night, bargaining. "I'd be fine with going to one of the lame Caribbean islands," Dan would say, "if not the lamest." And Tim would respond, "I don't even care if the hotel is nice. I don't care if it's a dump, if we're on the beach." One quixotic summer, when Perry had been captivated by the geography of the Iberian Peninsula, he announced they were going to go to Portugal for Christmas. Yes, it was a little out there to just up and take the whole gang to Europe, to cross the Atlantic the first time, not for London or Paris, but he had become fascinated by the idea of staying in one of the old monasteries. They all learned the word pousada that summer, though by Christmas the trip was no longer mentioned. Stunned when he awakened at last to the pattern, Dan realized his father had been playing the same game he and Tim played. He was trying to placate the gods by the modesty of his hopes, by the broad and unexacting range of what he would be happy with. When Dan at last made it to Disney World, the summer after his first year of law school at the end of an August that was sweltering in New Jersey, let alone in Orlando, He'd sent his father a postcard that he'd meant to be funny, but that he realized afterward might have been cruel. Next year, Portugal. In the elevator, coming down impatiently from his office, Dan clenched and unclenched his hands. He had been contemplating a takeout salad when Brenda Pierzynski, the SEC staff attorney on the Invictus case, had phoned. "Hey, Helgen, I'm coming out of court right now, and I got something for you guys on our favorite once and future perp. You want to meet me at the stands for a low-carb salad?" "Wow, that's appetizing. And in February, no less." "I know, but it's not that bad out, and I've only got 10 minutes. He emerged into the bright winter day. The fist clenching had nothing to do with Brenda. Whenever Dan got a promising piece of information on a case, he felt a surge of combativeness, as if the good news couldn't last. Someone would fuck something up, and Dan would be deprived of something. They'd subpoenaed John Curtis's cell phone records a couple weeks ago. As usual, the information was coming in dribs and drabs. And Dan had good reason to be paranoid. For how many years had Martin Kerr's firm stood impervious, vexingly impervious, to a swelling stream of accusations? The two companies that had actually been ticked off enough to sue Kerr for stock manipulation had seen their lawsuits overturned. One, a microchip company, had found itself owing fines to Invictus when Invictus countersued. From all accounts, Kerr was like that. He wouldn't settle for just getting off. He had to go the extra mile to fuck the entity that had crossed him. But Dan had hope this Tuesday afternoon. "Ah, but I do, lad," he thought, channeling his youngest brother Andrew, who could do the brogue. The two lawsuits had occurred in the prelapsarian world of a few years ago. February 2009 was a different universe. Across the floor from him, Diane Costa was buried up to her practical gold stud earrings in the machinations of Bernard L. Madoff. Was it too much to ask that the crisis machine spit out Invictus as well? "I'd be happy with a single incriminating call," Dan said to himself in case the gods were still listening, if they ever had been. A single call. The winter sun blinded him, and he squinted at the little food huts on St. Andrew's Plaza. "What do you want, Danny? Hurry up!" Brenda called to him from her place at the front of the line of the Mexican one. "Quesadilla, Diet Coke." It calmed him that she thought the same way he would have, sneaking his order in at the last minute with hers so he wouldn't have to wait online, yelling at him to save him the hassle. The picnic tables on the plaza were empty, given the time of year, though Brenda was right. It wasn't that bad out. If Dan hadn't been so persistently underdressed, he wouldn't even have been cold. At least there was no wind. They chose the table that had the most direct sun, and Brenda took the plastic top off some kind of chicken and shredded lettuce salad and grimaced. "Ugh, yours looks better." "Have to agree there." She'd been dieting for as long as he'd known her. He wondered if their friendship had reached a level where he could tell her straight that her appeal was her red hair and her sun-weathered face and her warmth. That even if she killed herself to lose the 10 pounds, she'd still have the body type of a plump person. So it just wasn't worth the struggle. Probably not. Over his quesadilla, he glanced at her doggedly spearing a bite of lettuce with a plastic fork. Definitely not. Everybody had to have some stupid goal that kept them going. Perhaps it was vanity, but Dan sensed from her silences and roundabout questions, and from the way she looked at him, that she felt she might have married him, or someone like him, or even specifically one of his brothers, that she felt, with respect to him, that she had been cheated out of her heritage dibs, as it were. Pierzynski was her married and now divorced name. She was born a Murray. He never mentioned Gwen to her out of delicacy for her feelings, even when avoiding it was inconvenient and involved circumlocutions. And she never asked. But from some early conversation, she knew that Gwen wasn't Irish, wasn't from New Jersey out of New York. Woodlawn, as both Dan's and her grandparents were. She brought up the Irish connection a little too often, and that embarrassed Dan because she had the wrong Hogan brother. Dan was the one who'd gone to Notre Dame and stayed overtly Catholic, whose daughter Katie did the Irish dancing, and whose wife made Irish coffee in glasses purchased specially. Dan was too one-note for all of that. He just wanted to get out. Then again, he went right along with her when she mentioned it. He didn't want to crush her moments of joy and connection, so sue him. So, he took a bite of his quesadilla. Phone records proving interesting?
To his infinite relief, she nodded.
Oh, yeah.
Sounding like one of Mary's preschool teachers, she said, We've got not one but two suspicious trades.
The two of them had worked together on Curtis the first time around, on the Tamco investigation, when the guy was merely cherry-picking trades to make himself look good. While she'd want to make sure the SEC got their fines or industry ban or whatever they could, he sensed she would positively relish seeing Curtis fuck up on a criminal level.
Yeah?
He cracked open his soda, held the plastic bottle away from himself while it fizzed out.
Another pharmaceutical?
Because, you know, I'd be happy with just another pharmaceutical. That would be totally fine with me.
Nope.
Brenda grinned. She was having fun building up to the reveal.
Well, let her, Dan thought, steadying himself so as not to steamroll her with his impatience.
She deserved a little fun. She had a thankless job, in Dan's opinion. The stultifying effects of the government salary without the galvanizing cachet his office had, of putting the true bad guys behind bars. And a shitty divorce to boot. Her husband had just walked out one day, he'd heard. She never mentioned it. Slightly different scenario this time.
You ready?
She laid the plastic fork down, wiped her hands on a paper napkin.
So, he calls an investment bank a bunch of times in a week.
Okay.
This is in April of last year. Places a huge bet at the end of the week. On a Friday. Huge bet on nanotech.
She paused before she delivered the punchline.
The Friday before they're acquired by ATG?
Dan absorbed it.
Got it.
Turns out, of course, that the investment bank he was in touch with was advising ATG.
Okay.
He was loving this, but answered tersely because he didn't want to encourage her to drag it out.
And the other?
He prompted as soon as he dared. She drank from her Diet Coke, and Dan did as well, to have something to do.
Same deal 3 months later.
Now we're up to last summer. The calls, followed by a purchase of a remarkable amount of Eulalia stock. Only difference is now it's Eulalia and Dax.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Dan shifted on the bench. He felt hope tentatively stirring, as well as an overwhelming, potentially scuttling impatience to go and arrest John Curtis the fucking fuck this very minute. He could see 26 Fed, the FBI building, across the way, looming large and glittery in the winter sun. He had never been more conscious that he belonged on the other side, out with Frank DiNapoli, making arrests, the face-to-face contact with his shitheads, which Dan only got in court, this white-collar position a life he'd jury-rigged.
And who, pray tell, might the bank be?
It's funny. Brenda wrinkled up her face. It's a small bank, family-owned. She hesitated, met his eyes.
I was surprised, Dan.
Yeah, well, these days. He didn't want to sound dismissive, tried to put it another way. I mean, we're in the eye of the hurricane here, right?
Madoff,
skink or far, there's never been a whiff of anything. The psychological flood of true surprise.
Conservative place, you know what I mean? A reputation for being conservative.
Skinker? Dan said. For a moment, he was aware only of the mental gear grinding of trying to catch up.
Skinker?
You heard of them, right?
I mean,
on nanotech, 20 minutes after the last call, we get the trade.
20 minutes?
He repeated.
Yep.
Jeez. I know the guy. He said shakily, wiping his mouth.
You know what guy?
Asked Brenda, all business. Is this going to be a problem?
Oh, no, no, no.
He pulled his glasses forward on his nose and rubbed inside one lens with a thumb.
I don't know him. I've met him a couple times. Socially. My kid's school. We're parents at the same school.
Jedediah Skinker.
Ah, the big guy, the scion.
Well, with any luck, he's got nothing to do with it. This is a trunk line.
He wasn't thinking clearly.
A second too late, he chimed in.
Right, right, of course.
She didn't know. The fact loomed up in front of him like a giant boulder. But Brenda didn't know. Hadn't put it together. John Curtis and the big guy, the scion, were fathers at the same school.
In fact, Brenda went on chattily, He probably doesn't have anything to do with it. Listen to this. Drew, newest kid who works for me, has found a guy in the back office. You'll like this, Danny. She gave his hand a little pat. A rehabilitated guy who had a couple drug misdemeanors. Yeah, huh, I see. Oh, okay. Dan wondered if he sounded as odd as he felt. In the print shop, he was a charity hire of some sort. Some group, I'm forgetting the name, you know the one I mean. They help guys coming out of rehab find gainful employment. Outfit them, train them how to interview, provide references. In fact, wait a minute, where is it? She pulled out her BlackBerry and held it at arm's length, squinting. I just had it, bear with me here. Yep, yeah, here it is. Just what I thought. Your man Skinker is on the board, Fresh Start. That's the name. Sounds like a laundry detergent. Huh. Or a cat litter. Figures, Dan said hollowly. Yeah, what kind of a guy is he? I mean, other than Phillips Exeter, Harvard. I believe you just say Exeter. I'd never pass in high society, Danny. Brenda was juiced up, invigorated, the way Dan should have been. She must have picked up on the oddness of his reaction, for she said, But I mean, you like the guy? Dumbfounded, Dan didn't answer at once. Then he said querulously, as if they were arguing, Bank doesn't even have a website. Brenda looked at him. He pushed the last bite of quesadilla away. The smell was suddenly nauseating. He's got a place upstate somewhere, he added vaguely, knowing it was irrelevant but wanting to say something that sounded reasonable. Danfork? Danforth? Oh, yeah, that didn't come up, I don't think. Anyway, too bad. Brenda clicked her tongue. This is gonna suck for them, you're right. She stuffed her garbage into the paper bag. The salad only half-eaten. Suck big time, even if he himself is unstained. Although if it's just the one bad egg, she shrugged. They'll probably roll on down the road for another century or so. You guys already getting Skinker's phone records? He found that some part of him hoped they were not. Yep, we should know by the end of the week. Who was on the other side of the plethora of calls from Mr. John D. Curtis, the fourth of Invictus Capital Management. The fourth? No, I'm kidding. Brenda gave a laugh and stood up to go. Wanting to detain her, but with no reason to, Dan rose too. Do what she's doing. Don't look weird. But he added the D, right? I'm betting he'll tack on a fourth, too. Right, Dan said, too loudly. Wouldn't put it past him. It was even more disconcerting that he had missed the joke. In the meantime, watch yourself at those preschool events, Brenda urged. Will do. They threw out their trash and paused on the plaza before heading in their separate directions. It's a small world these days, Brenda allowed. She looked at him with kindness. A small world getting smaller. How crazy is this? You know my ex-nanny works for your boss? She named the current head of the criminal division. I hope she likes overtime. Dan let the banter go on a little long, leaning on the jocular tone. He had to prove everything was normal, prove he wasn't an emotional liability. The Skinker mystique was an article of faith on Wall Street. But for Christ's sake, he of all people should have been immune to it. Back in his office, Dan sat staring at the shelves of law books, at the congratulatory plaques on the wall the FBI had given him to commemorate his victories over the years. He tried to get his head around it. Get a grip, guy. Get a grip right now. Brenda had said it. They were a highly conservative boutique, Skinker. Underleveraged, overcapitalized. One of the only, if not the only, advisory firms still in private hands. In the founding family's hands, no less. As far as he knew, both the front office and the support staff rarely turned over. As to the lack of a website, it was known Skinker FAR executives felt they weren't the right hire for any client who would find them on the Internet. So, yes, the news was just a wee bit surprising. Dan pulled out a yellow pad and began to scribble notes on it. ATG and Nanotech. Eulalia and Dax. Invictus and... His hand hovered over the page. Here was where he needed to add Skinker FAR. He laid the pen down and ripped at his cuticles. The truth was, it hurt to go there. It hurt Dan to go there. Get a grip, guy. Get a grip right now.
Jedediah Skinker was a man who hadn't had to make the money he lived on, but had been handed it at birth. A fact that normally meant an automatic write-off for Dan, but that, in the case of Skinker, seemed to take on a possibility beyond his being lazy and undeserving. The money seemed to have given the man the freedom to choose, to have put him, as one hoped it would in one's own case, beyond all that. From everything Dan had heard and infrequently, though significantly, observed, one seminal conversation at an otherwise aggressively boring and pretentious St. Tim's Parents' Night having formed his main impression. The money had made the man rational, disinterested. He was the almost a-capitalistic head of a family bank. Stories abounded. The subway rides to work, the shirts with frayed collars, and the 20-year-old trousers that ripped in the seat during some important pitch meeting. The money itself he seemed bent on giving away. The one time when Dan himself had spoken to the man, on that fateful parents' night, Skinker had never said in the entire conversation what he did or who he was. Nor had he raised the sad, limp status flag so doggedly flown by their generation, where he went to college. He'd not so much as alluded to where he lived in town or where he went on the weekends. Dan had to drag the latter out of him. In fact, after inquiring politely about what class Dan's child was in, the man had initiated a conversation on the topic of, "I'm not making it up, I swear." Dan had assured Gwen afterward, "Farm drainage." He was going on about the efficacy of some type of drain, and in the middle of this, the guy's wife came over, a beautiful brunette who had the kind of looks that made Dan feel sheepish because they were so beyond his ken. In the first place, she was half a foot taller than he was. Her remarkable face seemed to give the lie to America's conceit of being a classless society, some tenacious claim in her bone structure, in the length and shape of her bare arms and fingers, that all of the old distinctions were still in play, for those who knew enough to recognize them. Whereas people like Dan and the rest of the pretentious Ivy League bozos standing around the preschool classrooms, well, they were just kidding themselves. They should take their flat screens and their flashy label wine and their souped-up cars and go home. Then the woman spoke to her husband. At the first slurred phrase, Dan did a double take. Nobody got drunk at these school functions. Ever. Hell, nobody even got tipsy. That was the prerogative of another generation. Today's parent body was founded on control, control, control. Dan himself would never have made the mistake. Much as he craved a second red wine, he had stood cracking and peeling apart his plastic cup, and finally ripping it into little pieces for the better part of an hour. In Skinker's situation, most men would have given in to the embarrassment, made a crack or drawn their spouses aside for hot, terse words. Skinker was neither embarrassed nor jocular. Skinker was stolid. The man's face reflected no emotion, yet oddly, overhearing his wife's request that he put her into a taxi made Dan feel acutely supernumerary.
"I'd better go home. Will you put me in a taxi?"
"Of course." No more than a dozen words between them, and Dan found himself staring at the floor as if trying to avoid ogling blatant PDA. The low tones, the intimacy of the request. Was that darling she'd called him? It made him squirm just remembering. Skinker excused himself and saw her out, then returned cheerfully a few minutes later to resume the drainage conversation. So, yes, these particular drains, French drains made of some type of perforated pipe, was it? There was some issue with standing water near his barn, upstate, Dan gathered, in Danfork or Danforth. When Skinker got into the details, Dan lost the thread and found himself barely looking at the man, but inwardly studying him. Not so much a trick from the office as an innate habit his job in the U.S. Attorney's Office had made use of. Rumor had it he had been farming, had been living upstate as a farmer when Hugh Skinker, the father, dropped dead of a heart attack, and he had to come back from, what was the actual name of the town? Dan needed to check on that, and at his mother's request, take over the bank. He could find out the name of the town, and then, with a jolt, Dan realized that he had already put Skinker into the category of a person of interest. With misgivings, he wrote Jedediah Skinker across the top of a new page of the legal pad, then took his pen and perversely blacked the name out so thoroughly that no one would have been able to make out what it said. It wasn't until he was heading home on the subway that Dan's thoughts finally caught up with the facts. He was sitting on the hard seat, his eyes scanning the ads, mentally rejecting their claims one by one, when it hit him. It was all backward. It made no sense. There was nothing in it for Skinker. He sat back carefully against the seat, trying to look relaxed as his mind raced. It was all backward. It was a fundamental element of insider trading. The tipper had to get something for the information, even if that something was intangible. Social connections, social standing, an implied in into an elite club. He watched people file out and others press in at the next stop. Of course, it ought to have been the other way around. Skinker ought to be getting something, not giving. A guy like him would never be tipping a fuckhead like Curtis. Skinker was the scion of the bank his great-grandfather had founded. Skinker was the son of a socialite who was on the board of one of the uptown girls' schools, the names and nuances of which Dan prided himself on not keeping straight. John Curtis was the bottom feeder, the benthic organism trying to transform himself into a top-level carnivore. Dan gave a paranoid grin around the car. In all probability, the St. Timothy's connection meant nothing. No doubt it was a big, fat red herring dragged right across his particular path to throw him off. Because sure, the old Dan Hogan would have found it a wildly implicating coincidence. Yet the fact that Curtis and Jed Skinker were both fathers at an uptown preschool didn't mean that either one even knew who the other one was. Men didn't hang out at the school. Although, according to Gwen, a certain kind of man did exactly that, ostentatiously chaperoning a field trip to make it clear he didn't work for the man. He was the man. But also, according to Gwen, there was a lot less of that after Lehman. Gwen had said the Curtis kid had started just now, in January. The incriminating calls predated her arrival by months and months. Brenda was right to give him funny looks when he'd jumped, long jumped, to the conclusion that Jed Skinker was involved. It was a type of megalomania, thinking that the guy you knew was the guy. Even a storied old firm could have one bad apple. The druggie in the print shop Brenda had mentioned, for instance, if you wanted to start, oh, just anywhere. Or some trustworthy senior banker who had recently turned 55 and had had the jarring realization that he was going to die one day. That was the moment the reliable, straight-ahead income generators acquired mistresses named Destiny, whom they met in Florida strip clubs. Dan had seen it many times before. A man couldn't simply write checks to his Destiny. The wife would see them. Instead, a tip on a stock that just might go up. Destiny, rather than confronting one's destiny. Dan's mother-in-law had a saying she repeated like a tick. You're dead a long time. Anything worth a night to forget that. It was only the paranoid part of Dan, the jumpy, compulsive part, that could hear Gwen saying the Curtis's admission to St. Tim's. Oh, come on. There must be hundreds of people who could write a check. Curtis wasn't there when you went over, was he? Dan said as they finished supper. John Curtis? Gwen shot her husband a look. A dad at a playdate? Sometimes it seemed the men really didn't understand how things worked. No, I figured, just thought maybe he made an appearance or something. Nope, it was just the girls. Gwen felt a tremor as she said, the girls, for she had purposely left out Philippa when Dan asked her about the playdate. Some protective instinct kicking in. Though whether she was protecting herself or Philippa, she couldn't have said. Dan had met Philippa only once, but he had taken against her. At a parents' night at the school nearly a year ago, Dan had spent the evening talking to the Skinkers. Gwen had pressed him afterward about her old acquaintance. You must have said something to her. Not really. She left early. But I mean, how did she strike you? Fine. Attractive, obviously, if you like that emaciated I'm an alien from Mars type. Dan. Later she brought it up again, marveling. Everyone said she would be a model, but to me it's still crazy that she actually managed to go from dunning. She was wasted. Dan practically shouted. She was drunk off her ass, okay? What am I supposed to say? Gwen blinked. Nothing. It was like her school days, when Camilla hadn't cared for some girl Gwen had started to go around with. Gwen learned to keep those friendships to herself. Even now, when she went home to Natakwa, she'd tell Camilla she was meeting some high school people downtown. when what she really meant was that she was getting a coffee at McDonald's with Karen Kuhn, who'd had an abortion in 11th grade. It put Gwen on edge to have Dan grilling her again when there was so little she could tell him, beyond describing the gargantuan apartment for the third time, how it had felt like being inside a bank. Corporate, you know, no personal touches. As if it all might vanish tomorrow. Rented paintings, that kind of feeling. Were they rented? How would I know? Earlier in the evening, as she passed Mary's bedroom door, she'd heard Dan asking Mary what the Curtis child was like. Mary had thought about it for a moment, and then said soberly, "She has lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of toys. She has Wii karaoke." "Oh, yeah?" Dan sounded sycophantic and not himself in a way that faintly repulsed Gwen. "People don't need that many toys," Mary said. And because she was quoting her mother, Gwen had hurried away toward the kitchen, ashamed of spying. Now Dan said absently, "Right, right, and so, I mean, what about the Skinkers? They're not friends with them, are they, with the Curtises?" Gwen was startled. "What, the two couples, you mean?" Dan shrugged. "Yeah, or the moms, maybe. I don't know." He scratched his temple, shifted in his chair. What a brilliant prosecutor her husband must be, Gwen thought. All the tics and gestures showing his diffidence, his distractedness, his bored impatience with whatever information she could provide. All while ruthlessly extracting it from her. "She's very egalitarian, Minnie," she said brightly. "I think she's had everyone over once. She doesn't seem to have favorites or even really to care. She goes right through all the motions. You don't get the feeling that forming a real connection with anyone is part of the plan. But she does go through the motions." Gwen knew she was talking too much, the way a liar does to cover an omission. But Dan didn't say anything. She had the uncomfortable feeling he knew she wasn't telling the whole truth. But she believed in keeping some things to herself. Men didn't need to know the details of their wives' female friendships. They irritated them, made them jealous, maybe, because they didn't have those kinds of friendships. They flew solo. Dan did, anyway. "What a creep, huh?" Dan snickered and went on as if John Curtis were suddenly back to being just a name he'd known in college. "Didn't he attack some girl freshman year?" "Who, Curtis?" "A few girls." Glad of the change in subject, Gwen elaborated. "At least, according to the rumors, who knows if they were true?" His BlackBerry buzzed, and Dan glanced at it hopefully. "Sorry," he said, sounding relieved. "This'll be quick." "They're doing an approach tomorrow, Guy in Westchester." He held the device to his ear. "Frank?" "Yep, no, it's fine, it's fine. Shoot." He moved the phone away from his mouth. "Just leave them," he said in an undertone as Gwen cleared his plate. "I'll put them in the dishwasher."
"There's hardly any," she murmured. "I'll just do them. I'll be off in a sec."
"It's fine," Gwen insisted. "I'm just gonna do these because I want to go to bed early." She was soaping the last couple of dishes while Dan issued instructions to his agent, not thinking of much of anything, when her hands seemed to slow of their own volition, then stop. Her face sagged. She felt flattened. She could not go on. It was as if she'd been given a piece of very bad news earlier in the week, as if someone had died, and she had managed not to think of it until now, to put it out of her head with some extreme, pathological form of denial. But now the news had come back and felled her with its force. "A few girls," she heard herself saying, "according to the rumors." "Didn't he attack some girl freshman year?" "A few girls, at least according to the rumors. Who knows if they were true?" She let the tap run on, wasting water, listening to the subtle variations in its steady gush. Who knows if they were true? Why had she introduced falsehood into the conversation? Why the undermining comment? Gwen slowly sponged and rinsed the sole remaining plate, noting, appreciating even, its white plainness, and thought about college again for the second time in a week, when she hadn't thought about it in any kind of depth for years. As if that time in her life, with its briefly intoxicating possibilities, and its even more rapid curtailments of the same, still had power over her, a Yorkville housewife in her mid-30s whose life, despite the notable geographical change, wasn't turning out so very different from her mother's, after all. Freshman year again. Gwen had found her crazy next-door neighbor Melinda in the bathroom crying, a mess, one morning very early. The girl just home from her night out when Gwen was getting up for a run before her required Spanish class.
¿Y a ti te gusta también bailar?
A Chinese-American girl from L.A. Melinda was dressed in her usual melange of cutoffs, holy fishnet stockings, Converse high tops, and a ripped sweatshirt. Her dark brown hair with its streaks of peroxide blonde was a beehive mess. Whether it was snarled or teased that way on purpose, Gwen had never worked out. She and Gwen weren't friends. Such an association would have had to cross too large a campus social divide. But they knew each other from the entryway, and their encounters in the landing or in the bathroom had a pleasant, lingering quality to them. Melinda had confessed to Gwen that she was an erstwhile Group 4 person, math and the hard sciences, who was pissing off her parents by doing anthropology instead. Gwen would rib her sometimes and tell her it wasn't too late to come back, get a real major. Melinda had come across Gwen in the college library late one night, when she was tripping loudly through with drunken friends, and told her afterward, "You remind me of my father, Gwen. You're so hard-working." Gwen would sometimes catch Melinda looking at her with a funny expression of approval. "My father would love you," she had said. But now, early on a weekday morning, Melinda was looking at her own wrecked, mascara-stained face in the mirror, as if seeing herself dismayed her. She was sobbing and wiping at her eyes with bits of toilet paper she was tearing off a roll on the sink. Gwen swallowed, felt herself stiffen. The walk of shame, girls called it, and they laughed. Hollowly, Gwen thought. Gwen didn't really see the humor in it, just as she didn't really feel the compunction to take back the night. Another popular campus trope of women's empowerment she had been introduced to. She couldn't help it. She found the early 90s university brand of feminism shameful. She had been raised to think of the poor. The $5 bill she put in the plate on Sunday quite literally associated with the impoverished people who lived down the road from St. Agnes's people, like Patty McLean, whose clothes were sad and poor,
or the Gagnons, who you knew never went to the dentist.
Women's issues. She could imagine the look that would cross her mother's face at the mention of such a thing in a setting such as this. Still, she said dutifully, "Hey, are you okay?" Melinda shook her head wordlessly, her eyes large and brimming with tears. "Oh, no, what's wrong?" Gwen said quickly, though she had a pretty good idea. "He..." The girl started to cry in that hyperventilating way, her chest heaving. She stopped every few words so she could get enough air to go on.
He...
Gwen squirmed inwardly at the naked display of emotion, the likes of which never occurred in her family. She felt an intense sense of distraction come over her and had to force herself not to look at her watch.
"I passed out. I was just lying there, and he was fucking me, Gwen. He raped me. He raped me. Oh, my God. I was passed out, and he raped me."
The frank description appalled Gwen, maybe more than the idea of the act itself. She managed to reach out and pat the girl's shoulder.
"Oh, Melinda."
To her surprise, Melinda embraced her, bawling, squeezing her tight, her mouth open on Gwen's shoulder. As awkward as she felt, Gwen was touched that Melinda would choose her for this confession, that she would consider Gwen Babineau worthy of physical contact. When Melinda got control of her breathing, she leaned against the sink and cried it all out to Gwen.
"I must have had 10 beers. I did tequila shots, jello shots. Oh, God."
Gwen nodded. Melinda's eyes searched Gwen's.
"You know who I mean, right? John C..."
Melinda's voice caught on the hard C and she couldn't go on.
"From upstairs."
She choked out. Gwen could have screamed at the absurdity of it, that this person could be back in her life only 2 months after the cheating scandal.
"I was just lying there. I passed out in the room, and when I woke up, he was...
"It's okay.
Fucking me."
Despairingly, Gwen tried to hide how fidgety she felt. They were having a quiz in Spanish today. She had planned to go over the words in her head while she jogged up Science Hill.
Oh, God, I don't know where my underwear is.
Helplessly, Gwen listened as she became even more distraught. It's lost. I lost it there. It's still in the room. I didn't even say anything. I was flat on my back, and I didn't have time. When I left, I mean, I didn't even tell him to stop. Her voice broke. I didn't tell him once, not once. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. What am I going to do? She wept openly now. What am I doing? Oh, my God, what am I doing? What if I... Melinda let out a harsh bark of a cry and stopped. She wiped her face on her sleeve and looked at Gwen. The piteous look in her eyes seemed to clear in the wake of something harder. Do you think I should go to the police, Gwen? Oh, I don't know about that. It was like the time she dropped a piece of her mother's wedding china on the tiled kitchen floor at home. Gwen's remorse was instant and total. She felt the shock of the irrevocable and desperately wanted to rewind, wanted Melinda to embrace her again, depend on her again. But Melinda suddenly seemed to withdraw inside herself and, with a shift in her body language, to reject Gwen, to release Gwen, though she no longer wanted to be released. Panicked, Gwen tried to strike a jocular tone, say something that would comfort Melinda. In her misery, she punched the girl's upper arm and said the first thing that came into her head. I mean, after all, you were pretty drunk, right? They were never friendly again. Melinda didn't snub her. It was worse. She was flatly courteous. Silenced, Gwen dreamed of getting her day in court. 3 years later at graduation, when her parents got stuck in a buffet line with Melinda's parents, and they were all four of them very friendly and pleasant, the two dads trading gripes about small business ownership, Babineau's Garden and Lawn, a buffet lunch restaurant in a strip mall, a hope for reconciliation had risen up in her. The warm embrace. But when Melinda quietly turned her back so as not to have to speak to her, Gwen wanted to scream the words she had long ago formulated. Well, if it wasn't your fault you were so shit-faced you couldn't see, then whose was it, pray tell? Although by then the argument felt hollow, even to Gwen. For in a miserable extended rebuke, she had found out there were others. An incident at a fraternity house sophomore year, an off-campus party one of Dan's roommates had attended. But John Curtis had reached a certain amount of celebrity at that point, due to the investing he was doing out of his dorm room. They said he had made $20,000 for Vint Prince, and that Vint Prince's uncle wanted in. Gwen put the plate heavily into the dish rack, as if the weight of it were suddenly too much. She wiped her hands on the towel and spread it out across the plastic rack screwed to the door under the sink. She could hear Dan, still on the phone, pacing, making monosyllabic assents. He wouldn't notice the oddity of her standing there, standing motionless at the edge of the strip of kitchen, looking past a reflection to the windows of the former tenement building across the street. The single man who lived in the apartment opposite them was going through the exercise routine he followed nightly, jumping jacks and squat thrusts, rigid self-discipline for some long-term pursuit. Well, she respected that. That she understood. She would have done as many squat thrusts as it took. They threw you in together at these colleges because you were smart, got good grades, took BC Calc, got a 5 on the AP Chem exam. No one warned you. No one told you what the expectations of your views were going to be. You were just thrown into the teeming, high-achieving Ivy League mass and expected to pick up on all that. Or, rather, the college probably hoped the students would have intellectual debates, you representing your background and ideas, others representing theirs. They didn't count on the snowballing of the dominant opinions. You got left on the sidelines, unaware that you had the wrong views. Then, when it was too late, years and years after, when you had spent college hanging out with Dan Hogan and his crowd because they could see the humor in the spelling of the Women's Center, you saw dimly that you might have said to Melinda, "Why not, if you think it would help?" Or Gwen rebuked her former self, her nails against her palms. You might simply have said, "Yes. Yes, Melinda, you should go to the police. Yes, Melinda. And I'll go with you. I'll take you there." Instead, she had gone on her run up Science Hill, rehearsing the tricky Spanish preterite in her head, not shirking from the irregular verbs, forcing herself, in fact, to repeat those a greater number of times than the easier ones, to ensure that she would get an A. Chapter 11. Heather Baird got out of her cab on 80th and Madison, waving madly and calling to Jeannie Haskell, whom she'd spied loitering on the corner, probably so as not to be early. Jeannie hated to be early.
Don't tell me you're alone again.
I am, Jeannie cried. They seized each other's arms, beaming.
Doug's got his glass tonight.
Yes, Bert's in London. The two women fell into stride as they walked up the block toward the Steins' townhouse.
We can hide in the corner again and gossip.
Perfect, perfect. Can't you tell how much I was hoping you'd be alone again, too?
Which one is it? Do you remember?
Heather and Jeannie slowed reluctantly in front of a triptych of townhouses. Was it the brick Federalist one with the climbing vines? Or the Italianate one with the second and third story balconies? Or was it, perhaps, the one in the middle with the entrance down the stairs and the extra floor? Jeannie looked quickly back. Neither of them wished to be overtaken by other arriving parents who would authoritatively tell them which house it was. Extreme wealth had a quality of fame to it, making people hoard knowledge as if it were a direct line to insider status. Not that either Jeannie or Heather wanted to become an intimate of Lally or Ron Stein. They just didn't want to have to ask.
That one, isn't it?
Said Heather doubtfully, pointing toward number 9.
I don't know.
In Jeannie's hesitation, the massive front door of number 7, extra floor, was drawn back.
The Steins?
Inquired a blandly superior young man in a dark jacket.
Yep,
said Heather angrily.
Yes.
Yep, yep, yep. They squeezed down the short stairs, falling over themselves to show that they had known all along which house it was. Jeannie was already pushing past the young man and into a low-ceilinged vestibule that led to the house proper. Heather scuttled after her, and together they passed through an iron security grill, left open for the evening, its keypad flashing minute green and yellow lights. Were they? Jeannie wondered as she cast an eye up to the vault-like ceiling and noted a security camera, being recorded. They paused inside, bewildered by the glut of marble that confronted them, though they had sworn to themselves that they would not allow any material thing tonight to take them aback.
So great Ron and Lally are hosting again, isn't it?
Said Heather loudly, refusing to be intimidated by the 5-foot-wide marble staircase that swept in an arc up to the second story, or by the expanse of white marble floor spilling toward the institutional-sized kitchen, the latter bustling with an army of uniformed cater waiters, or by the marble walls hung with tapestries. But her voice sounded small. The room was denuded of furniture, save for two massive sideboards, made of some kind of petrified wood, that faced each other across a vast stretch of cold white stone. Jeannie, too, snatched a few glances this way and that as a second tall, smooth-faced young man silently whisked their coats away. In their hesitation, a 30-ish blonde in a double-breasted red skirt suit, her hair drawn up in a secretarial bun, came forward.
"The Steins are happy to greet their guests upstairs," she announced, and gave the pair of them the placating smile practiced by customer service professionals on unruly clients.
Though surely they had done nothing to alarm her, Heather thought, miffed by the authoritative gesture the young woman made, her open palm arcing out from her midriff as she funneled the two of them toward the stairs. Side by side, they trudged up them obediently, conversation stifled.
That song
coming from the piano upstairs. Jeannie hummed a few bars under her breath, grasping at it. It was some 1930s show tune, and the words escaped her. Perhaps they had played it at her and Doug's wedding. If it was up to her, she would have had a DJ, but her father had insisted on a band. The stairs opened onto the...
What?
Heather wondered, glancing uncertainly around.
What do you call it?
Not the parlor floor. That sounded kitschy. Deep Brooklyn Victorian. Make a million in the startup and renovate a Fort Greene brownstone.
The piano noble?
Bits of her required lit courses at Colgate would pop into her head at random. The gloss of the liberal education she had acquired before heading straight to the econ major. She was going to move to New York and make some fucking money. But that phrase conjured a palazzo warmed by ambient light, orchestral music swelling, French doors opening onto balconies, the pleasures that even Heather, who wasn't particularly well-traveled, had grasped Europe alone could provide. This room was so chilly and abstract, its simplicity not soothing but ferocious. This was wealth not as comfort or enjoyment, but as a cold corrective measure, as if some $1,000-a-day decorator was having his vengeance on the inhabitants. There wasn't a book in sight, of course, or a work of figurative art to reassure one of one's own existence. What must have been 17-foot-high ceilings made the group of parents huddling in the corner behind the gray, ultra-suede sectional sofa appear dumpy, as if the room had been made for a larger, more significant race, one that didn't have to stuff itself into pantyhose or pay through the nose for monthly highlights in a condescending salon on Madison. It was no wonder Lally Stein, there she was on the threshold with that Gwen